All right. So this morning, we get to jump back into a series that we started last week. And you just have to wear the victory shoes after a night like last night, right? I actually thought about wearing a different pair of shoes because I figured all my Michigan fans are sleeping in this morning, right? They'll be here at 10:45. some of you are like, oh no, we're here. Like we toughed it out and we still showed up. I love it. So this morning we get to jump into week two of a series we're calling the Songs of Christmas. And so if you want to follow along, we will put all the words on the screen again, but if you want to follow along, you can jump with us to Matthew chapter 2. We'll be in Matthew 2 this morning. We're going to be looking at a story in Matthew 2, but the story we're going to look at actually comes out of, so the Songs of Christmas, how many of you are Christmas music people? I guess, how many of you are like, this is like your least favorite genre of music? Like, Christmas music doesn't show up on your radio. Some of you? One of the things I love about Christmas is regardless of whether or not you like Christmas music as like a genre of music, there's this fascinating thing that happens in Christmas music where it kind of defies the logic of traditional music genre, right? Like, how many of you, okay, so thinking about genres, how many of you are like, you're rock people? Like, you like a guitar, like some of you. How many of you, you're here and like, you're one of those people that claims country music is actually music, right? Like, some of you are the classical people. Some of you are like the folksy alternative stuff that doesn't show up on the radio. One of the things I find fascinating about Christmas is Christmas, like, it deletes all of the genres. And during Christmas, everybody starts singing the same songs. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what type of music you play. During Christmas, everybody starts singing the same songs. Case in point, you could pull up Twisted Sister's A Twisted Christmas. Anybody ever listen to this album? It's weird. Like, sermon creation process brings you down some weird rabbit trails. This was one of them for me this week. Twisted Sister's A Twisted Christmas. You could pull up this album, and on the intro track, you could listen to them sing the weirdest rendition of Have Yourself a Merry Christmas you will ever listen to. Then you could finish with Twisted Sister and you could put on Garth Brooks' The Magic of Christmas and you could listen to him sing the same song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Then you could go to one of my favorite versions of it, Coldplay rocks. Anybody who like Coldplay? Come on. That makes me sad. But Coldplay plays this version of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And then if you want to keep going and listen to Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, you can listen to it by Frank Sinatra, Michael Bublé, Kelly Clarkson, Sam Smith, Whitney Houston, like, if you jump to John Denver and the Muppets, like, they collaborated on this song. Kermit the Frog is on here. Shaggy, Brian McKnight, everybody sings the same song. So it's this fascinating thing about Christmas. Genres go away. All these bands, regardless who they are, Sarah McLachlan, remember when she just wanted you to save the animals and now she's singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, right? But the fascinating thing about Christmas is, yes, everybody's singing the same songs, but then there's something about those songs that I think in a way some of the songs we hear, some of the songs we sing, have a way of kind of shaping our understanding of the stories. That a lot of our Christmas songs will kind of tell something about the Christmas story. And I think in a lot of ways, those Christmas songs shape the way we understand the story. So today, we titled this one, O Come All Ye Faithful. And I want to look at, in the song, we just sang it. It's, O Come All Ye Faithful. In the chorus, there's something about, O Come Let Us Adore Him. And so I want to look at a group of people, a group of maybe faithful people who came to adore Jesus. Last week, if you weren't with us last week, we looked at one group. We looked at the shepherds, and we looked at the story of these angels showing up to the shepherds and declaring the good news that a baby is born. But there's another group in the Christmas story that shows up and worships Jesus. Anybody, who's the second group? We've got the shepherds, and we've got the wise men, right? The wise men, the magi, and like, O Come All Ye Faithful doesn't necessarily name them, but there's another song that does. Anybody know the other song that names that group of people? We Three Kings, ah, well done. We Three Kings, which then begs the question, like, hold on, we first answered wise men or magi, and now we're referencing We Three Kings. And so what I want to do is I actually want to put, like, the first four lines of We Three Kings on the screen. I'll either read them, and let's, do we want to sing it together? Okay, I'll read them. I'm the one with the microphone. It's terrifying. We three kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we traverse afar, field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star. And one thing I want to name right off the bat, I realized in putting the sermon together, I sang the song wrong my entire life. Like, verse 2, bearing gifts we traverse afar. Like, I thought when I first stumbled on the lyrics, like, I thought I found, like, the old King James version. So I was scrubbing the internet looking for the real version until I, like, eventually I became convinced this was it. So I went back and listened to a couple people sing them. Not Twisted Sister, but I listened to some other people sing them and realized I had gotten the verse wrong the entire time. I thought it was always, we three kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we traveled so far. Which feels like it makes sense, right? Get this, I called my buddy Tim, who's pastor over at South Harbor. I was like, I had the song wrong the entire time. He's like, I did too. He goes to tell me that when he grew up, he thought it was We Three Kings of Oil and Tar. Like an oil tycoon is showing up, like Jerry Jones is walking into, what is happening? But so We Three Kings of Orient are, bearing gifts we traverse afar. I want to play a game with us this morning. The game is with these lyrics in mind. What I want to do is I want to jump into the story to read the story of these people showing up in this Christmas story. And then we're going to come back and ask how much of this is right and how much of our understanding of this story is shaped. Is it shaped by the song or is it shaped by the story? Matthew chapter 2. Verse 1, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw a star when it rose, and we have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So our game, we've read the lyrics, we've read the story. So if we put the lyrics back up, I kind of want to go through, like, kind of line by line quickly through the song. So if we put the song back up, "We three kings of Orient are," anybody have any issues with the line? Anybody? Oh, somebody named it. Okay, how many were you told show up? It doesn't say. Matthew simply doesn't tell us. We're told there are three gifts. We are never told there are three people who show up. Any other issues with the first line? There are three, what does Matthew tell us? Matthew will tell us there are three magi. Right? There are three magi. We sing there's three kings. So, I mean, what is a magi? Like, some of our translations have said wise man, but, like, it doesn't say kings. So who are these people? Like, it doesn't say there's three. It doesn't call them kings. All we know is magi come with three gifts. So people come with three gifts of Orient, like, bearing gifts, we traverse afar. Sure, okay, I'm okay with that one. Field and fountain, like, they're They're walking past fountains. Like, what is, that's weird. What is a moor? Right? Like, when I think of moor, I think of like, I think of the Shire, right? Like, it's this Lord of the Rings, following yonder star. So some of it's fine, but sometimes our theology, our understanding of the story gets shaped more by the song than by the story. And so what we want to do is I want to dive into, especially that big question. Like, so if there weren't, we don't know that there were three. We aren't told they're kings. We're told they're magi, and we're told they're from the east. So who are these people? Well, if they come from the east, we're given, Matthew gives us a clue. So let's go ahead and put a map up on the screen. I've been longing to put a map back up on the screen. So if we look at this, Israel is, so you have that blue on the left is the Mediterranean Sea. The Mediterranean Sea, to the biblical world of Israel, they understood that is their western border. It makes sense, right? It's a sea. You can't go any further west once you hit the Mediterranean. They understood their eastern border to be, do you see, you've got the Sea of Galilee, the river, the Dead Sea. They would have understood in the biblical world, their eastern border is the Jordan River. So technically, people coming from the east could be anybody coming from the right side of the map. So we know in biblical times, like the Moabites were over there. So are these magi coming from the Moabites? But we get in trouble because the Moabites didn't have people in their culture they called magi. So who are the magi and where are they coming from? And why does it matter in our story? Well, in order to figure that out, we need to zoom this map out a ton. So if we zoom out, can you see on kind of the bottom left side of the screen, you can still see the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, way in the bottom left. Do you see way, if we're looking east, way on the right of the map, can you see there's kind of a darker section coming up from the bottom right, kind of up left? Can you see that? That is the area that in the biblical world, early in the biblical world, Babylon is going to be over there. Babylon is going to be defeated by the newest big empire on the scene. That's kind of how it worked, right? Like, you were in control until somebody bigger came along and defeated you, and then they were in control. So it started as Babylon. Babylon would become the empire we know of Persia. Any guesses where the word magi comes from? It's Persian. The word magi is essentially a Persian, it's a Persian world. They are Persian word. The magi are a group of people that are highly esteemed in the nation of Persia. So you can already tell on this map, Persia's a long ways, right? We have a long ways from Persia to Israel. It's going to be a distance of hundreds, somewhere in the 600 miles, if you go from Persia straight over to Israel. But the Persians would have had another problem. Because I often use this color version of map because I think it looks good on the screen. If we throw a colored version to show us some of kind of the climate, what you find, you see that what was dark brown in the bottom right is now a bright green. And it's bright green because there are actually two rivers, you can kind of see them in that area, that feed it. These two rivers, they actually overflow every year. They leave a bunch of mineral-rich soil on either side, on their shores. This area is quite fertile. Those two rivers are the Tigris and the Euphrates. Maybe you've heard of them. But that dark region on the right where Babylon, where Persia is, you notice if you're there and you head straight left to get to Israel, what do you run into? Deep, dark brown. In the ancient world, in today's world, this is a deep, difficult desert. It's the Arabian Desert. Let me show you a picture. This is what that desert looks like in a chunk of Jordan. This is Wadi Rum. It looks like Mars, doesn't it? Like, you should film the Martian there. Like, it looks like Star Wars. It looks like Mars. Now, if you're a group of Persians, and you're about to set off on a journey, how many of you would look at that and go, oh, that looks like a good route. We should go that way. For hundreds of miles in the ancient world, there is no water, which means there are no villages, which means there are no people to provide for you on your journey. There's simply no way the Persians, these magi, when they leave, there's simply no way you look this direction and go, that's the route we're going to take. So what do you do? If we put the map back up, You notice that dark green on the bottom right. If you follow it, it'll go up and to the left. And then you notice the green kind of levels off and goes straight to the left. And then you hit the Mediterranean and you can follow green down. Do you see that? There's kind of the top half of a circle. Do you see it? That is what's called the Fertile Crescent. It'll follow the rivers, get up to the top, and then it'll take the Mediterranean right down. If I actually go to a current version of Google Maps, you can still kind of see it. So on the bottom right, you see that kind of that green area. There's growth there. You then follow it. You then see the river coming up to the left. You then hook over flat, and then you come down the Mediterranean. It's the Fertile Crescent. In the ancient world, if you're going to travel from Persia to Israel, you don't go through the desert. You're going to follow this Fertile Crescent, because along the Fertile Crescent, when you're following the Tigris, the Euphrates, when you're following the rivers, there's going to be water. That water is going to provide for villages. You can grow things in the Fertile Crescent. People are going to live there. There's no wonder why that's where some of the largest empires in the ancient world existed, because you could build an empire in a place where you have water, where you have farmland, where you can make things grow. So you're not going to go straight across. You're going to go up and around. So that 600-ish mile journey becomes a whole lot longer. So I wondered, in 21st century West Michigan in my office, I was thinking, okay, how long would it take? So I asked Google. So if we wanted to drive there today, it would take roughly 28 hours to go from the bottom right of the Fertile Crescent up and around and come back down in Israel and end up at Bethlehem. 28 hours. For some reason, it wouldn't tell me miles. So it's 2,089 kilometers. If you're somebody where, like, kilometers mean nothing to you, like they do often to me, right? It's somewhere around 1,300 miles, 1,300 miles. 28 hours by car with modern roads and engines. How long is it going to take you if you are a group of two, three, however many magi in the ancient world heading from Persia? This is not a journey you count in days. This is not a journey you count in weeks. This is a journey you count in months. We actually have a story in our Old Testament of somebody making this journey actually relatively quickly. Because there's a point in the Old Testament where the Israelite people, they get conquered by Babylon. So a lot of them get carried off. So they end up in Babylon. When Babylon gets defeated by Persia, there's this new king that comes into reign. His name's King Cyrus. Cyrus told the Israelite people, he said, I'm going to let you go back to your hometowns. I'm going to let you go back. I'm actually going to give you money on your journey back so that when you get back, you can build the temple. He's essentially trying to get them to be okay with him as their leader, because he's letting them go home, but he's just going to tax them ridiculously, right? But when he sends them home, there's a guy by the name of Ezra. And in the book of Ezra, there's a book that bears his name. It tells about his journey. It says this in Ezra 7. It says, Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. He had begun his journey from Babylon on the first day of the first month, and he arrived in Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month, for the gracious hand of his God was on him. So he left on what day? The first day of the first month. He got there on the first day of the fifth month. How long did it take him? 4 months. Took him 4 months. First day of the first month, the first day of the fifth. But we're also told he was quick, right? That last sentence, for the gracious hand of his God was on him. So we know Ezra did it in 4 months with the help of God. How long did it take the Magi? It can be done in 4. It probably took a whole lot longer. Because did you notice, you might have skipped it in the Matthew story. Often in our heads, we have the Magi showing up like right on the heels of the shepherds, right? Like they're still at the manger. It's still infant baby Jesus. But in the story, the Magi don't show up to the manger. They don't show up to the cave. They show up to Jesus' house, which actually leads us to think this story happens later. King Herod is going to respond, and he's going to kill every baby boy 2 years old and younger, meaning Jesus is probably not a newborn. He's probably a little bit older by the time these Magi actually show up. And then did you notice? So the Magi, They're going to travel this 1,500 miles around the Fertile Crescent. They show up, and did you notice what happens when they show up? Let me put it back up. In the next one, it says, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw a star when it rose and have come to worship him." You notice the Magi, they make this 1,300-mile journey to Jerusalem, and when they get there, they don't even know where they're going. Right? 1,300 miles, they have been on a journey for months. They get to Jerusalem, and they have no idea where to go. We're here? Where are we supposed to go? Like, where is this person? What are we supposed to do next? And to me, for some of you, I get it, maps are your jam. For others of you, you're sitting here wondering, like, what in the world does this have to do with anything? But to me, this story, when we hold it, especially next to what we looked at last week, I think it takes on a whole lot of meaning. Because last week, we looked at the story of the shepherds. Do you remember from the story, from your memory of the story, like, where are the shepherds in relation to baby Jesus? It says they're in the fields nearby, right? They're kind of right there. And that story, so like, they're already right there. There's not the giant confusion of where are we going? Where are we supposed to go? And who are we looking for? Like, the shepherds, they're right there. You have angels. You have this giant declaration. There's singing. There's song. There's celebration. That story feels very different from the story of a whole bunch of people from a different place traveling for months to get to a spot and have no idea where they're going. And where I love the two stories is I feel like in so many ways, that's what life feels like, doesn't it? That for some of us, we're here on kind of the weeks leading up to Christmas. And to us, it feels a lot like that story with the shepherds, where this season, this space in life that we're in, like, celebration comes easy. Like, we find ourselves in the spot where, like, big declarations and song and this giant heart swelling with gratitude. Like, it feels like that's where we're at. For some of us, we might be planning a first Christmas this year with a new child, right? You've had the Christmas outfit picked out for weeks. It's already laid out somewhere. You know what they're going to wear at every party, right? For the first time in your life, you've been able to wrap a present and write mom or dad in the from section, right? For some of you, you're thinking about Christmas and it's celebration and it's joy and it's song and you just find yourselves overwhelmed with gratitude. Well, in those moments, if that's what this season feels like, in those moments, let's not forget to do what the shepherds did, right? Because they find themselves overwhelmed with gratitude, and what they do is they bring that in thanksgiving, right? They praise God. They give thanks to God for all of the things that God is doing. For some of us, life feels like that. For others of us, life feels more like that long, slow grind, right? It's been 1,400 miles, the Magi, 1,300 miles the Magi have been making. They don't know what to expect when they get there. They don't know where to go. They don't know who they're looking for. They know something's happening. They're asking for the one who's been born king, but they don't know where he is. They don't know how to find him. They're wandering around Jerusalem asking. For some of us, it feels like life has been a lot of just the slog of day after day, and you put your head down, and you're just trying to grind through it, and you're just trying to get there. For some of us, this Christmas feels a lot different than that one. For some of us, we're in a spot where we're also walking into a first Christmas, but it's not the first Christmas with, it's the first Christmas without. Right? For some of us, we find ourselves in a spot where we look around probably much like the Magi and go, I had all these expectations, I had all these hopes, I had all these ideas of what it would look like when I got there, and now I look around and go, I don't know where I am. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what it's going to look like next. And what you do is you just kind of put your head down and you just keep slogging. But if you're honest, it just kind of feels like a grind. For some of us, Christmas feels like the celebration is right there. For some of us, life can often feel like it's just, okay, we just need to put our head down and just get through another one. And then for the Magi, it almost feels like it goes from bad to worse. Because they show up, they have no idea where to go. They don't know where they're looking. And then they end up in the spot where I don't think anybody would have expected to be. It says, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all of Jerusalem with him. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. King Herod's going to call them in. King Herod, we'll talk more about him later. But for now, just know that like King Herod is, if the Christmas story has a villain, it's King Herod. Right? If there's a bad guy in the story, and there is a bad guy in the story, it is King Herod. And so these Magi, 1,300 miles, months worth of journey, they show up in Jerusalem, go, where is he? They then end up first, not at the place they were looking for, not with the one they were looking for. They end up in the actual presence of the one who actually wants to get rid of him. Right? They come looking for Jesus, they find Herod. It's like they come looking for Superman and find Lex Luthor, right? Like they come looking for Jared Goff and find Aaron Rodgers. Does that one work? And like they come looking for Ann Arbor and Columbus, Ohio, looking around like nobody wants to be here, right? You kind of have to play it. But they come looking for Jesus and they find themselves in the vicinity of the one who actually wants to get rid of him. For some of us, I imagine that is what it feels like, where it feels like we've had all these hopes and dreams and we look around and go, this isn't what I thought it was going to look like. This isn't where I thought I would be. And the temptation in that moment, I think, is the temptation, at least for me, when I'm in spaces like that, is just to, okay, this isn't what it was supposed to be. I imagine the temptation for the Magi is just to give up, just to go, you know what? It was a great idea. We followed the star. It brought us to this megalomaniac named Herod. Like, we don't want to be here. Maybe we just go home. Right? Maybe we just withdraw. Maybe we just call it. Maybe we just say, you know what? Maybe we'll just be done and we'll go home. But what I love in the story is they don't do that. They show up. They start asking the questions. Where is he supposed to be? Where do we go? They end up in exactly the wrong spot. But then I love the way they find him. It shows up right here. It says, after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. What they did is they didn't give up. They didn't just wash their hands of it and say it was a good idea, it didn't work. What they did is they leaned back into exactly the way God had revealed himself before. Right? The way God had shown them the way is by presenting this star. They get to Jerusalem. They start asking a bunch of questions. Where is he? Where are we supposed to go? What they end up doing is leaning exactly back into the way God was present with them before. And what they find is God is right there again and brings them right where they were supposed to be. Where I love this in the story is simply because of how God shows up. With the shepherd, if we go back to the shepherd's job at night was literally to make sure your sheep stay safe from all of the threats that could present themselves. So wolves, coyotes, anything that could be a threat to the sheep, you are going to spend your night basically just keeping watch. You're out on the hillside. The sheep would have actually worked as the gate to the pen or kind of the entrance to the cave with the sheep inside. And you are simply going to wait and you're going to be present. And to a bunch of people who are waiting that night, just simply being present and observing, God shows up in the sky in the midst of their watching. One of the things we know about Magi in Persia is Magi were people who had a high affinity towards like astronomy. They studied the stars. And so to a group of people who studied the stars, God shows up to proclaim the birth of Jesus. How? Through a star, right? It's almost like God is speaking their language to point them directly towards him. God shows up in a way that makes sense for them, that they leaned in. They leaned in to the way that God had been real to them in the past, to the way God had directed them in the past, and what they find is God is right there again. What does that matter to us? So as we're in this season, walking towards Christmas, we're on Christmas morning, we declare that God is present, Emmanuel, God with us. And the reality, I think, of each and every one of us in the room is that God, you have a language, right? The shepherds in the midst of their waiting, God shows up. To the star people in Persia, God shows up in a star. That for many of us, if we look back on our lives, we have ways, we know that God is present all the time, right? We know that God is here. We know that God is present. But there are ways, maybe unique to you, that God has made his presence more real to you through your life, right? We might not, I don't know many astrologers, I don't know many star people, but I know nature people. And I have good friends who will say the moment they feel closest to God, the moment that the presence of God becomes a real and alive to them is when they're out in nature and they're looking around at all of the things God has made, and it just overwhelms them with a sense of awe and wonder at the one who created all of it. For some of us, we're nature people. For some of us, I've got good friends who they would say they're music people. And the way it works for them, the way God often, most often, his presence becomes real and alive in them is when they're singing, when they're worshiping, when they find themselves, you know how the song becomes something you're singing and then you find yourself almost in it in a way, right? And the song is kind of singing you as you're singing it, and you find yourself in the space where you kind of lose yourself in it. I've got good friends who would say that those are the places that God becomes real. That I've got friends who would say it's in the deep study of Scripture, that as we dive in and we peel back layers and we continue to see more glimpses of just how big and incredible and powerful and good God is, that does something inside of me. So my challenge for you, as we spend these last few weeks going up to Christmas, is ask yourself the question, as you look back on your life, what is the language that God has spoken with you? To the shepherds, he shows up as they're waiting. To the magi, to star people, he shows up in a star. What is the language that God has used for you? What might it look like over the next couple weeks as we lean into Christmas to lean into that? Right? The magi started by following a star. They get to Jerusalem, they start asking all these questions until they lean back into the way God had revealed himself at the beginning. And in that, they find him again. What does it look like to lean into that? And if you're somebody who's here and you go, I don't know how to answer that question, maybe ask some questions to some people around you, some people that you look up to, and ask them, okay, what has it been for you? What does it look like for you? And often, I think we find that by trying some things out. That one of the things I'm excited about that journey through Lent is we've got a bunch of us who are walking through the story of Jesus' life in the book of Luke as we move into Christmas. If you don't have a this is how it happens, I'd encourage you, jump into that. Join that Facebook group, participate in it, read the stories, and let the stories inside. But whatever that is, what might it look like for you in the next couple weeks to lean into those as we look forward to celebrating God with us this Christmas? Would you pray with me? God, I am again blown away at just who you are. That you are a God who is so big that you have created everything that is. That everything bears your fingerprints. And you are a God who is so personal. That you know each and every one of us by name. That you would speak to each and every one of us in a language, in ways to help us see and know and experience you. And so God, as we lead up to Christmas, I just pray that you would continue to work through those avenues to make your presence, the thing that we'll celebrate on Christmas, God with us, Emmanuel, that you might make that reality known to us. God, we are grateful for who you are and for who you've called us to be as your people, as the church. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.